I've been redeemed. Beautiful song. Being redeemed is a basic element of being bought back. It's an allusion to an indebtedness, an enslavement. The Old Testament built on it with the idea that a person who owed money could actually become an indentured servant for a while to pay off their debt. And once that was done, their debt was paid, then they were free to go. And there were limitations on it as far as time. You couldn't keep somebody endlessly. It was a time derivative thing, and it had certain restrictions with citizens, with Hebrew people. But the basic idea is if you had somebody who could pay your debt, they could come pay the debt for you and redeem you. That concept of buying back a debt that you owe and yet somebody else pays is certainly built into the concept of what Jesus did for us and what he does for us. But we don't think about it from that perspective a lot of times because we don't sell or we cannot be sold into slavery for a debt. Now, we may have to be responsible for it, but somebody cannot imprison us for it or personally take us into their charge until we pay off our debt. Debtor's prison is something that's not been around in a while, but, you know, there's merit to it in one sense that people who take on responsibility for a debt are responsible for it. It's their charge. They take it on voluntarily. And that it should be held, at least to some regard. But the purpose is that somebody can pay it. And once it's paid, it's cleared. It really doesn't have to do a lot with our concept or our discussion of prayer and God's answering prayer, except in the general sense that God is the answer to all of our prayers. God hears what we need, and he's given it to us. Before the world began, God had already set into motion the Redeemer. Because God knew that human beings and their choice to be self-determining would make poor choices many times. And if God cared about us enough to do that, then we take responsibility for it. Most parents realize when they have a child or several children that the course of life will be fraught with difficulties. You know, there's no such thing as a perfect world from the birth time of birth until that child is a grown person. Till you, if you, Lord willing, if you outlive, I mean, if they outlive you, they will lay you to rest and you won't see their final demise. But sometimes you do have to see that, or you have to see them get sick, or you have to see them go through tragedies, and you can't prevent them from it endlessly. But even with all of that responsibility, you know, we don't regret it. We just hope that we have what it takes to help them. God, I don't think, ever regrets, and in one sense maybe he does, regrets making us. It says that he regretted and repented that he made the world. But if he did that so absolutely, then there wouldn't have been 8 people on the ark. He would have just simply destroyed everybody. So apparently the human race in general had a hopeful perspective from God's thing. Ecclesiastes is, as I mentioned this morning, a fascinating book, one of my favorites in the Bible because it is so pragmatic. There's no book like it in the Bible because it's written from a perspective of a man who was very seriously challenged in his faith. Faith challenge, we would call it today. Whether he ended up faithful in the end, nobody knows. The debate goes on about the nature of Solomon. The Bible tells us when you read the history of Solomon in Kings and Chronicles, it always ends on a negative note. You know, he had many wives and he loved the palaces, or he built altars in the city of Jerusalem for all of his wives' various gods, and he turned away from his fathers, and he did evil, and that's kind of where it ends. Ecclesiastes ends in a different point, where he says that the whole duty of man is to love God and keep his commandments. The most oft-quoted verse in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 12, verse 13, that the final analysis is the whole duty of man is to fear God and keep his commandments. Now, if that's the end result of Solomon's life and that's what he did, then Solomon fixed it at the end. Or if it is consistent with his book, he knows that to be the truth, but he didn't live up to it. Now, you probably have people that have told you in their lives when they were maybe out of fellowship or hostile to Christ for a while, that they never quit believing. My brother has told me many times, and he was out of fellowship and lived a pretty rascalous life for a good bit of his late teen years and his early years, up till the time he was about 38, 39, where he was into everything that he shouldn't have been into. But he said he never, ever in all of those times didn't believe the truth. And he said he actually would tell people and teach them and preach to them, even in states of intoxication. He said, I've preached the gospel to people. But he said, I would tell them. I said, this is the truth. I just can't live up to it. You know, so you know, how do you reconcile that? Well, he couldn't reconcile it. He just said, I know it's the truth, but I can't live up to it. And I think that's kind of where Solomon is in this book. And I would love to think that he ended up on a final positive note. But he's kind of in the boat where he realizes that the world makes sense if you look at it from God's perspective. But I just can't let it make sense to me. Solomon was too smart for his own good. You know, smart is not a bad thing by any means. I like to think I got a little sense, and all of us like to think we got enough sense to get up and get going. But, you know, you run into people sometimes that really think themselves out of truth. I've met many of them. I've had people tell me, you know, that the more they studied the world, the more they turned away from God, because God didn't have a place in the scientific, realistic world of human thinking. Well, he does. They just have outstripped his involvement in their way of seeing the world. His things didn't seem to fit because it's got too many miracles in it and too many supernatural things. But properly understood, those things are not contrary to truth at all, and certainly not contrary to science. So how do we factor in the fact that the world works? That things work, generally, for everybody. You know, Bobby's prayer about this virus, and, you know, everybody's concerned about it, and, you know, it's certainly worth being concerned about. At the other hand, how many challenges has the earth faced, have the human race faced? You know, bigger than this one, smaller than this one, I don't know how many. You know, disease and famine and death. You know, if you'd lived in Africa for the last year, you would have been thinking that God is punishing you with plagues of locusts. Anybody read the news? You know, millions. I mean, these things that they haven't seen before. And a little while, they'll be gone if they're not already. And people will forget they were ever there. But in the middle of it, you think the world's coming to an end. You know, we're cataclysmic by nature. We love the adrenaline flow, I think, of something new and something different, something exciting. But sometimes we pay the price, you know, because we get ourselves in, or the world gets itself into situations where you can't. I've often thought of living in Europe in the 13th, 14th century when the Black Plague, you know, the bubonic plague hit it. You know, a quarter of the world, a third of Europe died. Can you imagine? It's hard to even imagine that kind of fatality rate. And there have been others, not nearly as bad as that, where people, you know, they couldn't ignore it. Even in our country, at the end of World War I, you know, the flu, the end of influenza, it went through some kind of a change, and it killed about 18 million people. Not only in this country, but all over the world. And it was pretty overwhelming. But barring those events, and there are those, and there will always be those, most days in our life are remarkably normal. We have everything we need. Blessings abound. We never think about it. That's why it's so surprising, you know, when you go to the store, as people have said, and you want something and there's nothing there. You know, it sends a shock through you. Well, you know, what would I do if we go there and all the stores are empty? There's no food left. Then you'd be in Ukraine in the late 1900s. I mean, the 1980s and early 1990s, when people waited in line for hours to get a little bit of bread. You know, that's not been so long ago for those people. We haven't been in that situation in this country probably since the Depression. And even then, the majority of America didn't live like that. A lot of people did, more than should have. But waiting and begging bread is not in our perspective. So when we have plenty, it's easy to think it'll always be plenty. But we need to remember, as we talked about in our lesson this morning, that what we need, God knows we need. And if we let him know that we know he's involved in it, he is always aware of our connection to that. And to think that we don't have any part in it is a ridiculous notion. You know, I thought of doing a lesson on answered prayers, but you know all the stories. You know, in 1 Samuel chapter 1, Hannah prayed that she would have a child, and God gave her Samuel. God told her, Hezekiah was told that, you know, his days are numbered and he doesn't have any hope, and he begs for more time, and God gives him 15 more years. The Psalms filled with prayers, and you read the life of David. David was constantly talking and asking God for help, and God heard him. Jesus, the ultimate man of prayer. Almost so we'd think he would need to have prayer. He had a direct connection to the Father. But he prayed all the time. He went into the mountains and prayed all night. I've often wondered what he could have prayed about. Minutes before his arrest, he was in the Garden of Gethsemane praying. You know, lots of prayers in the Bible. And the Bible says God heard, in many cases, God heard their prayers. One of the most interesting is when Ishmael and his mother had been cast out by Sarah. They went out into the wilderness and his mother, Hagar, set the child under a bush because she couldn't care for him anymore. She was, her own life was in jeopardy. And that child, you know how old he is, it's not clear in the Bible, but he's probably close to, you know, he's an older boy, 13, 11, 12, 13, I would guess, based on Isaac's birth and age differences. But he's a young boy, not able to fend for himself all by himself. And the Bible says that God heard the prayer of the lad. That's the King James Version. You think that boy was praying? What was he praying for? I don't know that the boy was actually saying, "Dear God, help me." I think he was saying, "Somebody help me." Does God hear a child cry out for help? In that case, he answered it very, very directly. Does he answer every child's petition, every child's prayer? I don't know. I think he hears children's prayers. As simple and as honest as they are, you didn't get any closer to God than that. But the book of Ecclesiastes, last verse in that chapter 5, God answers him according, or answers him in the joy of his heart. We built on that phrase. God answers him. It is the hymn that's being described all the way back to verse 18. Answers him in his heart. Now, what does that mean? Well, the answer comes in his heart by joy. You know, there's joy, 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 joy down in my heart. We sing that song sometimes. It's an old song. And there were sometimes in vacation Bible school or somewhere you sing it, and when you say there's joy, 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 joy down in my heart, you know, there'll be a refrain. Where? And the next phrase, down in my heart. Where? Down in my heart. Where's that joy? What does joy in your heart mean anyway? You know, we may think we're not emotional or we're not driven by emotion. We shouldn't be as far as making our decisions about God. But if you're not moved emotionally, you don't understand the joy of Christ. The joy of sitting and realizing that God has blessed you. That the table is full. Your children, you know, how many stories could you tell? You sit down at a bountiful table on a holiday and your family's gathered around. Or any day when your family is there, intimate, immediate family of mother and father and their own children. You know, if you've had that setting in your life and now your kids are grown, if you don't look back on that and be thankful for you had that. And I hope when it's happening, those of you who have little ones, you know, create that environment. And relish the moment. Because that's really what life's all about. Not just eating. But say, we're together. And we've got plenty. We've got a house. We've got food. We've got each other. We've got enough money to get by. Things are okay. even when they're not perfect. We've got each other. You know, you see people that go through tragedy, tornadoes, you know, we've been talking about of late, and others. And when you see people that have gone through a loss and they find each other, you have pictures sometimes that the news builds up for a good reason, that a mother finds a child and the picture is them holding each other. They have nothing else. Their home is gone. Everything's gone. But they have each other. Do you think they're thankful for that? You think there's joy in their heart? Of course. Joy in what? There's nothing. They have nothing. But they have an answer. Now let's look at the bigger context. And going back to verse 9. And really it's this, the theme is developed all through this book. So we're diving into the middle. But it's a good place, I think, to pick up. He says, moreover, the profit of the earth is for all, of the world, of the ground, as New King James says. For the king himself is servant of the field. Basically, he says, we all live on this earth. And the earth provides. Even the king is served by the field. In other words, when the king sits down to eat, he's not eating king food. He's eating regular food. Now, it'd be fancier food, a higher quality food. But it's still grains and fruits and vegetables and animal products that come from the nation, from the world. He can't get anything else. Even the king is dependent on the agricultural system. I remember years ago seeing some bumper sticker about pro farmers, which I've always think of pro being important. They said, don't ever complain about the price of food with food in your mouth. Or don't ever complain about farmers with food in your mouth. And the point's obvious, right? If you're benefiting from it, be glad you have it. The king, when he eats, does he thank the field hands for bringing his supper to him? Probably not. But the point is, the earth provides. And that's his point. Remember, we are able to function because of forces way bigger than us. He goes on, he says, he that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity. Now, the next few verses, and we won't read all of this and elaborate, is basically the idea of contrast. You know, silver and gold, you know, Peter told the lame man, silver and gold have I none, but what I have I'll give to you in Acts chapter 3. You know, he's making the point that, you know, monetary wealth, earthly fame and wealth don't matter. You can't eat them. And as you'll go on, when you die, you can't take them with you. You know, what is more valuable? What do people value more? You take food for granted. You take a home for granted. You take family for granted because you're out looking for the almighty dollar. And I understand the need to make money and the need to have money. And the Bible's not against the accumulation of riches per se. It's against trusting in them because they don't carry you. Luke 12, the rich man. And God blesses men who are not always good people. Luke 12, the man has an abundant year and he says, I've got enough now to last me forever. Tear down my old barns, build new ones and put up and I'll sit back and eat, drink and be merry. Life is good. God comes to him that night and says, your soul will be taken from you tonight. You're a fool. What cost him? Does it always happen that way? Well, no. But the point is, if you think you can cover yourself or protect yourself by yourself, you're mistaken. You look upward, it's a whole different picture. All that man had to do is say, thank you, Lord, for the bounty. To have plenty. And to give plenty. And the idea of giving to those who don't have is a big part of what God describes as being a proper caretaker of the wealth God has blessed us with. Now he goes on, and in verse 15, this is where he sort of summarizes the idea that when you die, you leave. You know, he came forth out of your mother's womb. As he came forth out of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. Your hands will be empty. You know, what you came with. Job made that point in one of his statements of faith. You know, I came into this world naked and I'll leave the same way. I can't take anything with me. Silver and gold. Well, can you take food? Can you take homes? Can you take your family? Well, you can't take them either. But you take the meaning of them with you. God's not going to ask you in judgment day what your bank account looks like, what your portfolio looks like. He's going to ask the questions of, what did you do for those who needed help? What did you do with your family, your responsibility? How did you commit to your marriage, to your friends, to your children, to your church, to the fellow, your brethren? He's going to ask those questions. You know, and they are the only things that really matter in the end. People usually figure that out more as they get older. They get young, or when they're young, they don't think that way so much. They think of success and an accumulation of things. Certainly Solomon did. You go back in the early chapters of this very book, Solomon could find no peace in his own world. So he created a world of wisdom, of building, of drunkenness, of excess. Went through every stage of anything you can see anybody in the modern world do. There's nothing anybody does in the world today that Solomon hadn't done already. In the end of it, he said, it's nothing. It's worthless. I got all that attention. I got all that highlighted status, and it meant nothing in the end. The wisdom of the ages should resonate with anybody, but it doesn't resonate with many because it's endlessly repeated. Generation after generation. Children come up and they think, well, Dad tried. He had his bad days, or he had his wild oat days, and he didn't do so well, and he tells me not to do it, but I want to do it. I'm going to make it work. Well, they don't. And they end up in the same boat, and the cycle goes on and on and on. You know, you sow to the wind, you weep the whirlwind, the Bible says. You think you can do it? You think you can outrun reality? And again, it's not Satan's work necessarily, although Satan is more than willing for you to go that way. It's not that Satan causes bad things to happen. Just bad things happen to people who ignore the truth. You know? Verse 18. He takes it from the perspective now of the negative of all he said thus far. The world, everybody is dependent on it. You take it for granted. If you go after silver, if you go after precious things, you end up with nothing. You die and you go to the grave and there's nothing left. So what's the point? And that's kind of his conclusion. And he wants to be there. You get the sense that Solomon wants to conclude that the world doesn't make any sense. All is vanity and vexation of the spirit. That's a refrain throughout the book. But it keeps coming back to these little pieces like the next few verses that sound exactly the opposite. He says, behold, that which I have seen, it is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life which God giveth him, for it is his portion. It is good. Now, how can a pessimist say something's good? He wants to be a pessimist. He wants the world not to work. But it keeps working. You know, you just can't stop it. It's kind of like I was watching way back in the, I don't know when it was, way back maybe in the 70s. They were, you know, open heart surgery. It was relatively a new thing. Heart transplant, certainly a new thing. First one done, I was in 69 or 70, somewhere in there. And they were talking about these hearts. You know, they take the heart out. It would stop beating, obviously, from one person. And put it in the new person. And they'd keep it under controlled, you know, for protection of all kinds of things. They would sew all the arteries back and hook everything back up. And they said, you know, it was not that you had to tease it back to life. He says, you have to do everything to keep the thing from beating. I mean, that doctor was talking about the incredible nature of that muscle and how it's built, that it wants to beat. I mean, when they get close, you know, they're warming it up or cooling it down or whatever the case may be, and they're trying to get everything hooked up before this thing starts working. But actually, they were showing it, and this heart was just like pulsing, like, I got to go. You got to let me go. know, you just can't explain stuff like that naturalistically. God built the world to work. You just can't stop it from working. Have you ever seen a tree growing out of a rock cleft? Or a tree growing out and two big rocks split apart? Have you ever wondered how a seed can break open granite? What kind of power is that? A seed will find a way. And it'll grow. Nature works. And Solomon keeps coming back to that fact over and over and over. It is amazing, he said. In fact, it's a good thing that a man has what he has. It's good to eat and to drink. Now, he's not talking about eating and drinking and enjoy the good of his life in an excessive way. He's talking about ordinary life. He said it's God's portion to him. It's a gift. I hope we appreciate the answer to prayer. You know, when you ask God to be with us, you know, one of the statements in the model prayer of Jesus in Matthew 6 and other places, give us this day our daily bread. Have you ever thought about how simple that is? Lord, just give me something to eat. That's all you're praying for. And then when food comes to you, in some ways you say, well, I worked for it. You know? It's all my doing. God didn't do anything here. You hear some hard-headed atheist agnostics say things like that. Well, you did work for it. By the sweat of your brow. That was the warning and the promise God made to Adam and Eve. But it still came from God. The field feeds all people. He says in verse 10, every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. Now, he's not against being wealthy. He gave Solomon great riches, because Solomon had the wisdom to say, I need wisdom to lead this people. And he said, because you did that, I will give you what you didn't ask for, long life and wealth. He was wealthier than probably anybody on earth in his given day. Certainly equal to many. So he says, even if I give it to you, and you have the power to enjoy it, to eat thereof, then be thankful for it. It's not unchristian to accumulate wealth. In fact, it's not unchristian to pursue success in life. As long as it is in perspective. God is always a God of perspective. You can't serve two masters, he says. You'll either hate the one and despise the other, or vice versa. But if they are in its place, they are gifts of God. God has utilized wealthy people all through the Bible. Some key people. Some of the richest in the world. Abraham, Job, Joseph of Arimathea. Wealthy women contributed to Jesus' ministry and were extremely faithful to him, loyal to him. He didn't repudiate them. Because in those cases, at least most of them for most of their life, understood where it came from. There are people in our world that you know that have money that are generous with their money to God and look for opportunity to use what they have to serve God further. They don't bemoan the fact that they have because they are more than willing to use it for Him. Now his point in verse 20 as he comes to the end of this section, he says, for he shall not much remember the days of his life, that is the he that is eating and drinking and enjoying the good of their life. He will not remember the days of his life. That's the King James Version. He won't remember troubled days, I think is what the point is. He won't dwell on all the days of his life because you don't remember days like that. I don't, at least most people don't. You remember punctuated days. You know, you go back and you try to remember. You know, I'm always amazed when, you know, police shows, they'll come back and visit somebody and they'll say, where were you on March 13th at 10 o'clock in the morning, 2 years ago? Yeah, they're wasting their time coming to ask me that because I don't keep a record of it. And while I may give you a general idea, I couldn't tell you. And yet on TV, they just rattle it off. Well, I was down at such and such or whatever, you know. It's not real. Because most days are just days, right? They're not bad. In fact, they're good. In fact, the ones you can't remember are really, what he says, are the answer to the prayer you have. They're days of peace. You know, does a parent remember every night when their children are put to bed and those children lay down peacefully and go to sleep and they're well, they're full, and they're warm, and they're safe? How many times you put your children to bed and that's what happened? When they were burning up with 103, 104 fever, or when they fall out of bed and break, you know, crack their face or whatever. Do you remember those days? Well, of course you do. Emergency room days, you remember that. Do you want to remember every day like that? Don't you want to remember the days of quiet peace that are forgotten, that blur into the background? And that's what God is saying. Life doesn't have to be exciting to be wonderful. When you pray for peace and well-being, when you pray for giving us our daily bread, don't be surprised when you may not recognize that the answer came. You just didn't notice it, or didn't, you weren't attentive to it. Solomon is saying, good things happen as life just simply goes on. God answers us in the joy of our hearts. That joy in your heart is a very powerful thought. You know, what is it you want in life, really? You know, people who pursue greatness and stardom and money and power and prestige, do they ever get it? Do they ever have enough? Are they ever satisfied? You know, there are a lot of famous people out there that are just never satisfied. I feel sorry for them. Because while they may change the world and they are earth shakers, and many of the things we take for granted in our lives come from people like that. And they probably couldn't not do it if they tried. But if you want to do that, you're likely going to be very miserable in your life. Whereas you look at your grandpa, your grandma who had nothing, simple house, little garden, they sat down on the table and ate and went to bed at night and life just went on. Which life do you think is better? I'm using my own grandparents. I don't know if yours relate, but I saw that. They had nothing. But they had everything. Because they had joy in their heart. Peace. A peace that passes understanding. So when we talk about or think about God answering prayer, remember, God answers in ways that suit Him. When He asks for happiness and joy in your life, you may have some big picture of what that is. God has a different picture of it. God will give you what you ask for. It just may not be what you thought He was going to give you. The answer, many times, comes simply by a peace to where you can say, "Thank you, Lord, for what you give me every single day." To eat and drink and enjoy the fruit of your labor. Be glad God gives us a life. God wants us to be comfortable and to be happy in this life. You know, you may wonder what life's all about. You may wonder why, you know, what great thing. Everybody wants to change the world. Everybody wants to make the world different and better. You know, it's all nonsensical. Nobody can change anything. God's in control of this world. The world will be here as long as He wants it to be here. And your part in it is minuscule. The human race's part. You know, the human race today likes to think it controls the world. We shape the world. We don't do any such thing. We influence is our immediate environment, but we can't outdo God. But we find ourselves in His position or understand His position in our life. Then we can benefit every single day as small pieces of a beautiful puzzle that God is in control of. Tonight, if you're a Christian, you're not only a part of the human race that God cares for and provides for, you are in a special position of being His children by faith. If God cares for the world, the wicked and the righteous, what do you think He does for the righteous? effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. God pays attention to his children even more than the world. Don't you want that relationship? Hold on to it if you have it. If sin has crept in and brought you back into the world's thinking, then say, Lord, forgive me for being so foolish. Correct your life. Ask for forgiveness. Come back to him publicly, privately, whatever your sin requires. Don't let the world trick you to think it knows better. If you're not a child of God, come to Jesus. Put him on in baptism. Begin your life with him. Don't let the world, don't let Satan win your heart. Trust in the providence of God, the gift of God that is offered freely. If you have a need tonight, think about your soul while we stand and sing.